Good morning and welcome. Today, Professor Luke O'Neill on what promises to be an amazing new vaccine from a French company.
I think we have to understand the GDPR was not going to be implemented overnight. It is going to take time. And I think the more clarity as a regulator we can bring, the better it will get over time.
Data Protection Commissioner Helen Dixon on Facebook, Twitter, Ryanair on GDPR. Are some GPs being shortchanged when it comes to vaccine supplies?
Once the property goes sale agreed, then all the solicitors just start beavering away in the background for everything to just be finalised. Now, this can take 3 to 6 weeks. It's not an instant thing.
Just how difficult and long drawn out is it to try to buy a home in the middle of lockdown? And would you buy without an actual viewing?
Thank you again for stepping up in such a big way on tackling climate change. US leadership has been sorely missed.
Where to start? The complex foreign policy challenges facing Joe Biden. The use of drones for picking up COVID samples and delivering medicines to outlying places.
I hope it creates conversation about the expectations of motherhood, the expectations that society puts on us, that we put on ourselves. I also hope it's a book that gets people talking about nature versus nurture.
We meet Ashley O'Drain, the author of a controversial new book, The Push. Is the far right active here in trying to get retailers to open up against the regulations? And there's more too. Call us on 1890 453106. Text us on 53106 at a cost of 30 cent. Email patkenny@newstalk.com. We're on Twitter at patkennymt. But first, Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. How's it going?
It's going very well, particularly with the news you're going to give us in a moment or two about a vaccine from France. But before we do that, there is kind of the steady news from Johnson & Johnson in America.
There is, yeah. I mean, the FDA have said it's good, basically. They're highly efficacious, highly safe. We knew this already, mind you, but they made a statement yesterday and they'll approve it probably today. We get the official approval. So J&J will be our next vaccine to deploy. And as you know, Pat, our numbers depend on J&J because one shot vaccine keeps in the fridge, lots, millions and millions of doses on order by the EU. So that's our next vaccine to come to Ireland. I suspect it'll be in Ireland maybe 3 to 4 weeks from now, that kind of time frame.
And that's very good news, although in the United States, I think they were saying that the manufacturing is not going to deliver as many as Joe Biden perhaps had expected from J&J in the immediate future. But they will backload it, I think.
They'll still deliver
in a period of 3 months the same amount.
Well, they're one of the world's leading vaccine manufacturers. Remember that they're one of the top four, you see. So they know what they're doing, basically. I don't know why that delay has happened. Yeah, I guess they're managing expectations again, Pat, that kind of thing, you know. But I've no doubt they'll be making. They've said they're going to make 2 billion doses, remember, this year, they've said. So that's the kind of numbers we're going to get to eventually.
Now, the big news on the vaccine front, although we might be waiting a little while, is from a French company called Valneva. Tell me about it.
That's right. Yeah, I'd heard about this about 3 or 4 months ago, actually. It was yet another vaccine, if you like. Remember, we said probably 6 months ago there were like 50 in development, as you may remember. And Valneva was one of them. And they were looking good, French company. But now they've just announced they're really on target. Very interesting vaccine. This one could work against any strain. That's how this one might differ from the others. In other words, you don't need to re-engineer it. It could work against all the strains, basically. And they're going to have data in the coming months. It'll probably be approved in about, say, 3 to 6 months. Once that kind of time frame, we'll get the trials finished, you know. And it's another one, really. I guess, Pat, it's becoming very crowded, isn't it? Talk about a number of buses coming on at the same time. But this one looks really interesting. It's different to the others. Different technology, which is good. Another option, I guess. And it's the whole virus this time, inactivated. Whereas the other vaccines are all just a spike protein, which, as we know now, that's the main thing in these other vaccines. This one is the entire virus, which they kill the virus with formalin, actually, and now it's the entire virus. And that's why it won't be vulnerable to mutations, because there's many proteins in this vaccine, you see, whereas the others are just a spike. So it's most unlikely that a mutant will arise, which will change all its proteins, you know. So the prediction is that it'll work against any of the strains, really. Mm.
Now, have they used this technique before on another condition and therefore they kind of knew it was going to work?
Yeah, many, many vaccines are the entire virus killed, by the way. This is quite usual, like the polio vaccine, for instance. That was the whole virus that they inactivated. So it's quite a well-known technology. And again, this company have done this. They have a very effective vaccine for a disease called Japanese encephalitis, which works really well. And the CEO yesterday said he's just plug and play. So they've plugged COVID-19 into this technology and now they can play, you know. So it's a well-known technology. The second thing is it's got two very powerful immune stimulants in it. These are called adjuvants. One is called alum, again, well used in many vaccines, and a thing called CpG DNA. That's a very technical thing. But my lab works on that. In fact, we've done stuff on CpG DNA in my lab. It's a really good immune booster, you know. So they think this could really be a triple whammy, basically. You've got the whole virus, all the proteins there. The virus has been killed, of course, with two very strong immune stimulants, hence the optimism. I mean, yet again, Pat, it's going to be very competitive, isn't it? Let's face it. So which one will win? I mean, this one will be highly competitive against the others if it works against all the strains. You can imagine in 6 months' time, this could be the booster shot, basically, you know, that everybody will get in their arm in October, November time. So.
Now, is it one dose? Is it two doses? And critically, at what temperature must it be stored?
Yes, two dose. So that's a slight disadvantage, of course, compared to J&J, which is the one dose. But even still, many vaccines are two dose, remember, nothing unusual, and it keeps in the fridge. So we're well away now, Pat, from this ultra cold thing. As we saw last week, the Pfizer one will now keep in a regular freezer. So the issue of cold storage gets less of an issue all the time.
Now, in terms of the variants, can they make one that's tailored for a variant, or do they need to?
They don't. Yeah, they can just use this one. Now, that needs to be proven, by the way. I mean, it's most likely this will work against any variant. That's the evidence would suggest that. So therefore, you don't need to keep changing it every season. And you can imagine every winter anyway, you could use this or give it regularly. And then again, they might use it in children. They'll have to look for safety, of course, there, first of all. But it could, because it could be the one that will be the more convenient of them all. It's easy to make, by the way. But I mean, these inactivated ones are reasonably straightforward to make. They grow them in cells. They're called Vero cells. And they're well used to making them, you know. So again, it looks like it could be a pretty convenient one.
And there's some talk of them doing a, you know, a bivalent or trivalent or quadrivalent vaccine where they'd have, you know, just to be sure they'd have a bit of Brazilian, a bit of South African, a bit of the UK and all that mixed up. In other words, different components to the shot you get in your arm.
That's right. And big news last night, Pat, by the way, Moderna have already made one against a South African variant and now it's in trials already. The NIH. So all the companies are making vaccines now to the three major variants. The second piece of good news, by the way, Pat, was there's a thing called convergent evolution happening, which means we probably have all the main variants now. The chance of new ones cropping up, people feel, are less based on the evolution of these things. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we have the three major. There are other variants. Obviously, there's one in California now. There's one in Finland. But again, they're all quite similar, if you know what I mean. They've all changed their disguise in a way, in a similar way. So we could be at the point when we'll know what the variants are, at least for this season. Let's put it that way. So it's a bit like the flu again, I guess I remember.
And this Valneva vaccine, which could be, you know, the one eventually, how far are they along the road in terms of trials and when might it be offered?
Yeah, that's what they announced it. So they've started the phase two trial, which should be about 1,000 people. And then they're planning the phase three already. They're talking about Q3 this year. It should be ready in the sense that the phase three will be complete. It's easy to do trials at the moment because the virus is so common in many different places. So they get to the end point in the trial quite quickly. So they're talking about Q3 this year. They're hoping for approval. And again, that seems like a reasonable timeline with this one.
Now, with Ireland eventually going to have mandatory quarantining in hotels for maybe 20 countries or maybe everybody, depending on how things go, there is, if you like, a science behind doing an effective quarantine, because we know even in Australia, which has been doing it for ages, they've had their spillages, shall we say.
Well, yet again, Pat, I mean, the scientists have gone into those hotels and examined them closely in Australia and seen where the breaches were, because people get infected from those hotels. As you may remember, one family in Melbourne infected a worker, a security guard, actually, who then went to another job and ended up infecting loads of people. 800 deaths, they reckon, happened because of that single family, unbeknownst to them, of course, you know, infecting a worker in the hotel. So the Australians now know exactly how to build hotels for quarantine, and they've all these guidelines. Now, our hope is the Irish system will follow these guidelines because they are risky environments. These hotels aren't really built for quarantine. So there's a list of sort of, instructions now in Australia. They're even talking about moving them out of cities and putting the hotels in somewhere like Darwin or even in Alice Springs, I read, which is well away from the main urban centres because of the risk of them coming. But hotels aren't built for quarantine. But I mean, a big negative is the hotel room has positive pressure. So when you open the hotel room door, the air rushes into the corridor. That will push loads of virus, if there's virus in the room, on the person opening the door. There's one study, Pat, which showed a virus basically jumped. Two people opened hotel room doors on opposite sides of the corridor, and the virus jumped across the corridor into the other room and infected five people, you see. So they're looking very closely at how to make sure hotels are safe environments for it to stop spread.
Because many high-rise hotels, you can't even open a window because they've got air conditioning throughout and they want to control the environment and they don't want people letting all the hot air out, so then they have to spend more money heating the room when they close the window. But of course, a window that opens would be hugely important given how vital ventilation is.
Well, that's right. And they've looked at stagnant air. As you may know, Pat, if you ever go to a hotel, it can be a bit smelly, can't it, in corridors and places. The air stagnates in hotels because of poor ventilation in corridors. That's really bad for this virus because, as you know, it'll gather in a stagnant area. And if there's studies of a security guard walking through one stagnant area and getting infected from the virus in the atmosphere. You know, so again, hotels are seen as not ideal. Now they're changing the administrator to make sure there's good ventilation and so on. But we've got to hope that the hotels they use here will have correct ventilation. Yeah. That's the key.
Could imagine a long corridor of a hotel that they might have to open the fire door at either end to make sure there's air blowing through that corridor. It could be as simple as that.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Mm. And they've got studies of security guards sitting in one place for too long, and then the air stagnates around him and he gets infected. Because remember, this virus will just float like an aerosol on the breeze, you know, on the stagnant air, I suppose, and then infect someone. So these are really important considerations.
Now, you want to talk about outdoor sports, given that they're talking about resumption in the UK and when they should come back in Ireland.
That's right. Now, the UK, as you know, are limbering up now, as we've seen. And a really interesting analysis yesterday I came across was about starting sport again. Now, they're saying, and there's good evidence, that sport outdoors is safe, remember, especially golf or tennis or cycling, these various things. They're really safe activities outdoors because being outdoors decreases transmission usually anyway. So they're saying, look, we should start these sports again. And all we need to worry about is people come to-ing and fro-ing, the transport to the venue, obviously, whatever it is, you know, to the golf course, to make sure there aren't four people in a car, say. And then secondly, gathering is the big negative before and after sporting events. So what they're going to do, they're going to issue guidelines as to how to start these things again safely. The event itself is safe. It's more the transport to and from the event and then also the gatherings that happen. And then they say, why can't we restart these things? Because they're so important, aren't they, for mental health, for children playing sport, all those things. So the UK, yet again, will probably get there first, but we'll follow them. Whatever they're doing, we'll probably follow. And one strong recommendation I'm reading is in the UK, start that as soon as possible. Now, for us, the 8th of April seems to be our next moment, doesn't it? They should start sport after the 8th of April and start it in a safe way. You know, we know what to do now to limit spread of this virus, and you can restart these outdoor sporting events relatively safely.
So the important thing is that everyone knows what they're doing, because I think one of the complaints has been, you know, we don't have the proper guidelines. We don't have the rules that someone, you know, has scientifically thought about and worked out. What is the safest way to, you know, if you're a fencer, to fence with your épée, or if you're a tennis player, a golfer, a rugby player, a soccer player, hurler, whatever. And there should be protocols that should be worked out for all of these activities so people can tick the boxes.
And let's look at the data, Pat. To my knowledge, there isn't any evidence that golf was a source of infection or tennis was. You know, now, clearly, if you go inside and you're in a tennis club and you're indoors, then there's a risk, you know. But the events themselves, as far as I'm aware, unless I'm corrected, there's no evidence that they gave rise to infections when we had them open, you see. So they are actually very safe activities. Now, there could be guidelines. Some clubs, I know, issue their own guidelines, for instance, you know. But certainly you could have a standardised set of guidelines to allow golf, tennis and so on to start again. And it should happen in April. If our numbers are, you know, as ever, we wait for the numbers, don't we? But if the numbers are in the right direction, I can't see any problem with restarting those things after April 7th.
Now, we were talking yesterday about antigen testing in schools in France, in Spain, in Germany. They see this as part of the toolbox. There's no sign of it as part of the toolbox for the reopening here.
That's right. Yeah, I know. And it's been widely used now across Europe, I'm hearing, you know, especially in schools to have. And in fact, in Trinity, Pat, we do it. There's a big box in the lobby of my building now full of tests. and anybody can spit into it and give it in, and then you get a result, you know. So I think it's got to come out, and the school should have boxes full of tests as well, really, shouldn't they? Because it's pretty convenient now, and then you can read them quite quickly and see. So I think that has to come back. And again, more and more evidence, Pat, that the antigen test really tells you if you're infectious, whereas the PCR test is a bit too sensitive.
That's the key piece of information. Because the PCR will pick up, as we've said many times, shreds of the virus, even though you may no longer be infectious. And, you know, it's a test on the day anyway. It doesn't tell you that night, if you meet a pal, you won't contract COVID. So it's the same in terms of its, you know, its immediacy as an antigen test. But the big thing about the antigen test tells you that you're infectious or not.
Exactly. A big paper yesterday in one of the big American medical journals has confirmed that even more, you know. So the evidence around antigen testing has got stronger and stronger, and it really should be deployed widely. In this, the next phase is so critical. But we don't want another spike, do we? You know, the massive upsurge when we start to reopen. And antigen testing is a really good weapon to use to stop that.
Yeah. One of the listeners sent me in a chart from Reuters, I think it was, in terms of the days of lockdown. And we're in first place in Europe. 163 days workplaces closed. That was when this chart was drawn up. Italy in second place, 30 days fewer, 32 days fewer, 131. Then the Netherlands, 110. The UK, for all its troubles, 104. Belgium, 97. France, 84. Lithuania, 76. Austria, 73. But we're top of the list in Europe at 163 days lost, which tells us we did something terribly wrong.
Well, it's anyway, a strange one, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. You want to talk about pregnancy, people who are pregnant or who might become pregnant soon, and top of their list of questions is, can I get the vaccine? Is it safe?
It is. Now, this is really important. I get loads of questions myself, Pat, through email, various things from pregnant people, and they worry, which is understandable, you know. And more evidence, you're a vulnerable person if you're pregnant. You have twice the risk of infection, actually, during pregnancy than someone who isn't pregnant. So you're, you know, increased risk of getting infected in the first place. And then secondly, the people who are pregnant have more severe disease if they become infected. And then they get preterm labor. The babies are inclined to be delivered a bit sooner, you see. So they are in this vulnerable group. And absolutely, they should be vaccinated because that will protect them. The risk of getting really ill, you know, is much higher than any risk from the vaccine, which is really low risk. And again, what they've done is quite nice. But the Pfizer trial, which, remember, had 40,000 people on it. There were a fair few pregnant women on that trial. And again, there was no evidence of any harm at all. So there's the evidence that we knew anyway, because vaccines are safe in pregnant people. You know, we knew that from other vaccines. But again, that's been now shown that if you're pregnant and you have the Pfizer vaccine, it doesn't do any harm of any kind. And then it'd be the same with the others, by the way. I have no doubt that those are equally safe. So the question now is, should we bump? This would be the controversy. Should we bump pregnant women up the list now in terms of priority? They're not quite as vulnerable as, say, obesity or diabetes or those things, but they're certainly more vulnerable than the average person in the population, you know. So there is a case now, perhaps, to move pregnant people up the list and get them vaccinated sooner.
Now, the interesting thing about this, I suppose, is the way that a baby might be infected by SARS-CoV-2, by COVID-19, because, you know, not everything crosses the placenta barrier.
That's true. There is evidence this virus can cross the placenta. That's the other concern that we have. Now, again, there's no evidence yet of anything happening there, because pregnant women have got infected, remember, and they are more vulnerable and they might have a more severe disease, but they do get over it, you know. But and there's no evidence of any harm being done. But the virus can cross the placenta. They've shown that as well. So, again, avoid infection, obviously, enough just in case, and then get the vaccine as soon as you can. That's more reason to be vaccinated, because if you have the vaccine, that will kill the virus and then stop it crossing the placenta, you think?
All right. So there is so much science happening all the time. I mean, I think when we're talking on Monday and Thursdays, I think there can't be anything new, but
no,
there's always
alarming.
One of our listeners, Sheila, wants to know, how long can the virus live in stagnant air? Because we're all under the impression that when you cough or splutter or whatever, that the droplets eventually, you know, just go to the ground and, you know, you walk on them, but the virus can't really survive in those kind of conditions. So how long might they be hanging around in stagnant air before they fall out of your breathing range?
Well, that's a strange thing. Aerosols don't really fall to the floor. They kind of float, you know, they're like feathers, I suppose. They will eventually fall somewhere, maybe stick to the wall. A droplet will fall, of course, because it's bigger and heavier. But these aerosols, they just seem to linger like brownie in motion, we used to call this. Do you remember? Mm. You know, they're kind of just floating there in this stagnant air. And they can stay there for hours and hours and hours. And in that Australian study, you know, the last time there was any evidence of a hotel room door opening was maybe a day before. And there was still virus lingering in a stagnant corner in the corridor, you know. Yeah. So again, stagnant air is probably the most dangerous thing in some way.
How long would the virus last without a host, though, without nutrition?
Hardly. Well, that's the next thing. I mean, now, you know, as we discussed before, it is pretty fragile. You know, it doesn't last too long on surfaces because it has to live inside cells and so on. But again, it does seem to persist for hours in these aerosol situations. Surfaces kind of kill it. You know, when it lands on a surface, that surface actually might be sort of a bit toxic to it in a way, you know, whereas in the air, it's a bit different because it isn't touching anything. It's just floating there. So we think it lasts longer as an aerosol than it would on a surface.
I'll fire a few more questions before I let you go, Luke. Why is the flu vaccine so variable in its efficacy if we can get 90% plus for COVID for that vaccine?
That's a superb question. Guess what, Pat? They're going to make that flu vaccine more efficacious. That's a different technology again. The way they make flu vaccines is they grow them in chicken eggs. People don't realize this. They infect eggs with the virus and then they extract it from eggs. That's why people who have egg allergies sometimes are told not to take the vaccine. But now, of course, the great thing is that we've brand new ways to make vaccines with massive efficacy. That will now be used, I bet you, in other infections, just like flu. So one benefit from all this will be a much more effective flu vaccine. Watch.
Ireland Inc. should be getting in early with this Valneva crowd and placing orders, but I suppose that would be too much like taking the initiative. That's from Ed. And they will have a factory in Scotland, Valneva. So
that's right.
You know, yeah. Supply lines would not be too difficult.
Our UK friends have got in there. They've ordered 120 million doses from Valneva already. Yeah. The EU have ordered 60 million. So they should up the order, shouldn't they? Like, why wouldn't the EU? Yeah. It's a French company. You know, the EU should be ordering 500 million doses from Valneva, where the UK have got in. Isn't that interesting? So it just shows you how aggressive in a positive way the UK have been. I mean, they went around hoovering up any vaccine they could, basically. And now look where they're at with their vaccination campaign. So it's a good point. We should be more aggressive there for definite.
A couple of quick things then. Is there any problem getting the vaccine if a person had an anaphylactic reaction to chemotherapy?
No, again, as we've discussed, allergy is not a big risk factor here in a sense. I mean, they're just watched for 30 minutes. Any kind of allergy, if you have a history of that, tell your doctor, tell your GP, and they'll watch you for 30 minutes and you'll be fine. I mean, again, more and more evidence, by the way. But again, I think something like 50 million people are now vaccinated, which is incredible, isn't it? And you're looking at 30 cases of allergy out of that, which is minor, you know, so there's nothing to worry about there.
And a final one here, and this is the big question that science is working hard on. Any idea yet if vaccinated persons can transmit the virus?
Well, again, a great, as you said, the news comes thick and fast. A paper last night, again from Israel, yet more evidence that you won't transmit. You know, so it's really good. So there was that study showed a 90% decrease in transmission if you're vaccinated. And that's what we want to see, because if that's confirmed, that's fantastic news, because now it protects you and stops you giving it to someone else. Isn't that brilliant? Yeah. And by the way, for while I'm at it, the UK are about to allow nursing home visits. Have you seen that? They've just announced. And you can go and visit someone in a nursing home and you can shake their hand. They've given that instruction now. You can have physical contact now. Now, clearly, the person in the nursing home has to be vaccinated, obviously enough, and probably you should be as well. Certainly wear a mask. But they're about to restart nursing home visits in the UK. And again, that just shows you the confidence. I mean, I think that's partly because of this evidence. I mean, if the evidence is you can't transmit, then it's safe to go and visit someone who might be vulnerable because you're not going to infect them just in case you're infected, you know. So that kind of thing. So that gives us more hope, I guess, in terms of visiting people.
All right, Luke. Look, thanks very much. And we'll talk to you on Monday, unless there's some amazing development tomorrow, which there could well be. Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin, thank you very much for joining us. Now, later on the programme, we'll talk to Data Protection Commissioner Helen Dixon about the annual report. But next, we're going to hear how the ongoing restrictions are going to impact buying and selling homes. That's next on News Talk.